Now, welcome to In the Arena with Nick Stone. I became aware of Nick's story some time ago. I, obviously, coming from the football background that I do, I was aware of this young guy who did his best to try and carve out a career for himself in the AFL environment. Came through like many young people do, you know, was thereabouts for much of his career and played himself 20-odd games across six seasons with three clubs. So, as he describes himself, he was very much the journeyman. The next I hear of Nick is he pops up in various social feeds and he's now has an organisation, Bluestone Lane, which is America's fastest growing premium cafe brand. And it's quite a story. It's quite a story from the very moment, probably even the experience of being in the AFL environment through to where he sits now, the various challenges that he's faced, you know, particularly during COVID and in New York, you know, where his brand was certainly preeminent. This is a great story. He's a guy who, in the conversation we've had, it's not interviewing him. He's very much in the conversation. He brings a certain energy which you always understand and think and feel that he's trying to draw as much from this interaction as I am of him in regard to, you know, him being the guest, you know, of the podcast itself. This is a wonderful conversation. He's a terrifically generous person. He's very grateful for, you know, what life has actually given him, and he's grateful for the opportunity of sharing his stories with the people who listen to this podcast. So you'll love this. Nick Stone in the arena.
I'm here with Nick Stone, and Nick, you just had a really interesting coming together downstairs when you walked into eClub. There you ran into Nick Maxwell, and when I told Nick that you were actually Nick Maxwell, that you were coming in, he basically said, "Well, he's the reason I never played at Hawthorn." When you hear that, what do you think?
Oh, what a champion of the game! And we were talking about the serendipity of timing in the AFL. Everyone's in different journeys, and Nick didn't get. I get drafted at Hawthorn ahead of Nick, and then John Baird was the other guy who went to North, and then Nick ends up at Collingwood and has the stellar career, premiership, you know, captain, and all Australian. So it's funny how it works out, and it just sums up life. You know, like, everyone's on different journeys, and I don't use that word loosely, but the serendipity of timing and being in the right environment at the right time with a coach that believes in you or a mentor that believes in you can be the difference from being, you know, an okay player or an average player to being a champion. So, great to see him, and he's, of course, gone on to bigger and better things as always, and good to see him.
And I think almost even the insights that he drew from the times where it didn't work out for him, and we talked about this in the podcast that he had, and it was an interesting conversation because he thinks that he was driven by proving people wrong for a period of time, and then at some point shifted into, when he became a leader, proving people right, you know, as in the people who'd backed him in, the people who'd supported him during that period of time. So the disappointment was a form of energy or determination, or at least the source of that determination for a period of time. But in time it actually became, as he grew up and probably felt comfortable with where he was at, it started proving people right. And I look at your journey now, because you played your 20-odd games over 6 years. You would never have felt settled in the game, I wouldn't have ever thought. Would that be a fair?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
A really fair summation. It's interesting, when you come back to Australia, I come back once a year, it's when you actually start thinking more about footy and the foundational steps to where I am now. I've lived in the States for nearly 15 years. But AFL was so transformative in my journey as a person and professionally. And, you know, I look back on it, you know, I had a 2-year contract, and then I had 4 1-year contracts. So I was playing for my career every year, and I was a journeyman. I was 2 years at 3 different clubs. Very fortunate to always be Melbourne clubs.
Yes.
And I lived at home the whole time with my mum and my brother, which is fantastic, you know, safe environment and stable. But certainly for me, like, when footy was going to finish, or I think the uncertainty of football for me, because I never felt that comfortable. There's probably only one period when I was at Hawthorn in my second year, I played 7 games in a row. And it was probably about the 5th game that I had a breakout match, and I felt, wow, I can actually compete at this level. Yeah. It's during pre-season or in practice matches, I'd play really well, but it was then the psychology of and the fear of failure. I would go out there hoping the ball didn't come to me, hoping. And when I got the ball, the first thought was, don't make a mistake. And you don't. Then you stop playing on instinct, like the game that you've played. You know, had a million kicks and you've had a million handballs and you've played hundreds of games. Suddenly you start second guessing. And I remember to a point where I sort of became frozen in how I'd kick the ball, how I'd stop thinking about the biomechanics of how you drop the football on your foot. So for me, when AFL had finished and I found out that I was going to be delisted right at the end of list lodgement, and I remember the moment that list lodgement day was landing on my final exam at Monash University. And that day I was going to get a phone call whether I was staying on or being moved off. And I guess it was a bit of a coin toss. But I finished my exam. I saw there was a voicemail and a text, and I just said, no, I'm not going to do it. And also I thought, to be honest, that it was incredibly disrespectful to find out on the last day. And that was my last exam. I had finished my Bachelor of Business Banking and Finance degree. And with that chapter, I was so determined to not be the emergency, which I constantly was at St Kilda. I went from Hawthorn, where I played, you know, those 17 games, to St Kilda, where I played my best football, but I could never get in. And I felt like I don't want to have this insecurity. I want to be the star. I want to be in a place where I excel and I'm comfortable. And I always had that perspective. But for me, once footy was going to be finished, it was just so exciting because the world is now available. All these things that were never accessible because like I drafted when I was just about to turn 18. I had 6 years in the system. You don't do it. All your mates have been to schoolies and they're at uni and they're going out and having fun, and you know, you're in an elite environment. And for me, I basically had no pre-season because I was never good enough to take 4 weeks off. I always had to try and get an advantage to be able to compete, and whether it was my size or my strength or running ability or skill. And I just felt so incredibly liberated when AFL had finished. And I look back on it now and I feel also an emptiness and sadness that I didn't enjoy what was meant to be my childhood dream. That childhood dream was growing up to play AFL. And I had 6 years, and I think about it very rarely, and I don't think about it with a lot of positive moments and enjoyable occasions. And certainly at the time, I never celebrated success. I was always playing, you know, out of fear of failure and being in an environment where you're constantly unsettled, and there's just no way you can bring the best out of anyone, or let alone someone that had probably the mental. I probably just didn't have the evolution and the self-belief that some players that walk in off the street do have, but many. They need it to be cultivated and they need it to be invested in. And I think the game's changed, but like back then, you know, you're on your own a lot and you had to work it out. And I was lucky I was still at home, but I imagine some of these kids that are coming in, enormous expectation. They're coming from small towns. Their son has made it to the AFL and they're living in the city by themselves with a billet family with no money. That's the other thing. Like the compensation was so poor back then. Yeah, it's a lot to deal with at a very, very young age. Yeah.
Well, a couple of things come to mind with that is, and you know, now based in the States, and obviously Steve Kerr, Golden State Warriors coach and super player, one of their values is joy in the organization. They've brought that in. You know, I'm actually talking to our team at the moment. One of the values I'd like to really underpin with the work we're doing is come to play, this idea of come to play, you know, and come to play comes with the responsibility with that, but it's also play. Yeah, we want to play. We want to have fun. We want to enjoy bringing someone like you into this room, having the conversations we're having and being so grateful for that. You know, there is that element to it. And so the second thing which then comes to mind is could it actually have been different for you at that time? could it have, if someone at some point had helped you with the form of belief that you needed, that when the ball was in your hand, that that felt good?
Mm.
When it doesn't, when basically the game is about having the ball in your hand,
yes,
and the very thing which, you know, which you'd become most comfortable with all of a sudden become so uncomfortable for you. Could it have been different for you?
Well, if you just look at the data, like, of my career, I was in the system for 6 years at three times. So there clearly was a material amount of belief that I could make it.
Yes.
I probably had all the physical attributes, and I think I had the right values and commitment, and that kept me in the system.
Mm.
But I know of many players that that serendipity of time and the right environment unlocked a inner belief that they played at a better level. And we use the example of Nick Maxwell. I was selected for Nick, but Nick's, Nick played nearly 300 games, I think, and then
captain premiership.
Yeah, and I played 20. And there's other, you know, I think about a lot of players that I've played against or with that I would feel very comfortable at the time playing on in a practice game or intra-club game, and they played hundreds of games. So, but I look back on it that I was also so fortunate that my career wrapped up when it did, because my last season was in 2005, and that meant I was able to move from my degree to an internship at an investment bank, and that then got the juices flowing about the excitement of this new world of dealing with companies and financial markets and the opportunity to be an international global citizen, not just a Melburnian that's, you know, got a bit of identity linked to being an AFL player. And that was so incredibly exciting, because I began my career in banking in 2006. I was able to get a grad role and to come back to Melbourne, and I was able to start my graduate position early. I was very, very fortunate that when I was, my first grad job I got offered was at ANZ, in ANZ Institutional Bank. And I was in this new corporate finance team that had been set up by Joseph Healy, who went on to be the founder of Judo Bank and, you know, a lovely guy. And when I started, I was meant to begin with all the other grads in January, but with ANZ, I said to them, I'll only take this job, because I'd also applied for Macquarie and Deutsche Bank. And I said, I'll only accept if I can start in August. And they said, yep, you can start in August. So I was able to get a jump start, form those relationships. But more than anything, I'd been working in an elite environment for 6 years. And the transferability of those skills, you know, my finance, corporate finance knowledge was as limited as a grad, but the life skills, the ability to handle pressure, scrutiny, resilience, to communicate to senior stakeholders. Now, there's nothing like when you walk into an AFL club and you shake your hand with your hero, and your hero is now your teammate. I remember walking in, and we talked about this off camera, my first year at Collingwood was Mick Malthouse's first year, and I walked in the door and Dad dropped me off because I didn't have my license, and I don't think I was 18, to Victoria Park. And Mick, the first thing Mick said to me is, like, I got rid of one Nick Stone at West Coast and now I've got another one. And then the next person I met was Nathan Buckley. And I'm still at school. Like, I hadn't finished year 12. But that helped me so much in my next career, because as I moved in banking, and I was very fortunate to move very quickly into leadership positions at ANZ, I was presenting to the treasurer of Apple or the CFO of a very large multi-billion dollar company and giving them ideas on how they can create more value or how they can grow faster or manage risk. And I do think having exposure to an elite environment with a lot of scrutiny, with the need to innovate and think laterally. And for me, I was not going to be able to get to where I wanted to go in footy by doing the conventional thing. I was a late draft pick, so I was never going to be, you know, by a recruiter standard, like an absolute certainty to make it. I was drafted in the same year as Josh Fraser. Josh Fraser went pick number one and I went pick number 82. So I always had to think laterally about, like, how do I get an edge? And I applied that same thinking to banking. And I think that that, whether I did it consciously or subconsciously, I think that really underpinned a lot of the acceleration I experienced in that career, where, you know, I ended up being on the Europe and Americas leadership team at a young age, and in a number of different sort of pathways where you're earmarked to be the CEO of certain divisions. And so AFL played a huge role, but getting in when I did was also before the financial crisis, and it was a hiring mode, and there was some more stability in the banking industry, and then it was tumultuous. So I was very fortunate, because if I looked for my first job in 2008, say I stayed in the system 2 more years, then you're walking into the GFC.
Yeah.
And what happened to graduate recruitment was cut in half.
Yes.
So timing, you know, people say, you know, oh, you know, it's luck, or you create your own luck. I just think at moments in life, you just have this serendipity of timing. Like, it's just, there's a crack in the window and you're in the right spot. And it's also, you know, the same applies to tragedy in life, that people can just be caught in the wrong spot, and that's it. And, you know, it's been a combination of being proactive and owning my career and continuing to invest in improvement mindset, loving being part of a team, but being in the, putting yourself and giving opportunities to be in the right place where you can say yes. And for me, like, my burning desire to prove people wrong, to prove myself that I was not just a journeyman, I was not just a, you know, a very, you know, an average AFL player, that I wasn't going to play with any sense of fear or scared, that fueled my next professional endeavour into banking and finance. Yeah.
Yeah. What's interesting, I think, is you showed when you played at the highest level, because my understanding is that this never happened when you were playing, say, at anything other than the highest level. You felt real confidence at that level, that you actually wanted the ball in your hand if you were playing, say, in the reserves or the seconds or the second tier. That felt fine, you know. And one of my favourite lines in sport is, the most important person in a club is the one with the ball in their hand. So it is, and the ball's going to end up in your hand at some stage. And I know that autonomy is one of the values of, you know, of Bluestone Lane as well. So that goes to that idea as well, that the ball's going to end up in the hands of a lot of people other than you in an organisation the size of what it is, and we'll certainly talk about that. And you felt confident, but at the most senior level, you never felt settled enough to have that, perhaps that belief.
Mm.
But you were then put into a different world where all of a sudden you may have just had a little bit of advantage, just a little tad. Mm. Yeah, and the advantage might have been, you know, the experience of the previous 6 years, or the fact that you'd started in the job 3 months earlier or 4 months earlier. It could have been as basic as that. So whatever that little advantage was, or that little moment was, that quite quickly you found yourself in a place where most people would find unbelievably uncomfortable, you know, as in presenting in front of, you know, serious people on serious matters, but you were able to find a confidence and a belief at that time. Just talk me through that a little bit.
Yeah, it's interesting reflecting on it, actually. I think it's about, you have an opportunity to take advantage, and it's just whether you take it or not. But you're precisely right. When I played football, when I was in the VFL, in the twos, I dominated certainly my last 2 years at St Kilda. I probably playing my best footy, but I only played 3 AFL games. And Matt Rendell, I remember telling me at Moorabbin, I've never seen a player dominate the VFL as much as you, Nick, and not go on to be a really accomplished AFL player. Mm. I remember at the time, wow, that's like an amazing backhanded compliment. And I sort of was a bit chuffed. I was like, oh, God, I'm probably not going to make it then. But, you know, I think that, you know, when I played in the VFL, I wanted the ball to come to me the whole time, because it gave you the chance to showcase your skill. And it's amazing how much your mentality changed. I was still the same person. I had still the same attributes. The football field was the same size. The ball was the same. I was often playing against regular AFL players and beating them comfortably. But then you go up to the next and you feel frozen. You feel so... you know, when I think it's just so critically important to reflect, and I think also to talk about why you're feeling a certain way, and and have an environment that can liberate and move aside some of that anxiety. And with me, with banking, I think it was I just had an incredibly incredible support network. When you go into a graduate program, you really do get a lot of personal attention. Similar to being drafted, you know, they're making an investment. They're betting that you can generate a return for the club. And but I do think the life cycle or the tenure is shorter in sport than in a corporate, because when you join a corporate organisation with a really structured grad program and a diverse grad program, not just males who have great athletic attributes, they are thinking like, this person could work for us legitimately for 30 to 40 years and create tremendous value that can be quantified. And I found when I went into that environment, the fact that they said, we're going to be malleable enough to let you start early, jump the queue, break the process, and then to get that attention that I got from a couple of key individuals, Dion Smith was my first boss, and Andrew Moffat and Michael, all these guys, I remember all their names clear as day. I could not tell you all the assistant coaches at Hawthorn. Could not tell you now. Even if someone said, name them, you get them right, I'll give you $1 million. I couldn't. But I can remember everyone that's mentored me and developed me in banking.
Because of the relationship that you formed with them.
And I think the attention they gave me, and they cared so much about learning and education because they had this long-term vision. And I also think it was an environment where it was set up to be, there was always a presumption that you're going to be successful. When I think at the AFL clubs I went at to, there was a, I don't think that that was universally embraced by everyone. I think there was always a view like, that guy's probably not going to make it, and like, oh, maybe it wasn't a good draft choice, or and that's just, it's a lot to deal with at a very young age. And that's the other thing. I think there's just an evolution of maturity. And if you look at the US college sports system, they're going to college, they're getting 4 years of education about, you know, formal and informal, about life. They move away. They move from home. They're in an environment. They learn, they train. They start to experience playing in front of crowds and having profile and in a high-performance environment and challenge, excuse me. And that's very different from AFL, where you're starting them at 17 or 18, and if they're not at that age, they're pretty much not going to have a chance to play professional. So by the time I finished my AFL career, I was 23, just about to turn 24, and then I walked into banking, and it's like I'd been through my college equivalency. And
I was going to ask you that.
It's interesting.
It's almost as they got you as something more than a college graduate, didn't they?
More than a university graduate, that's for sure.
So even by comparison with the US system of a college graduate, because you'd had the disappointments, you'd had the setbacks, you'd had to dust yourself off, you know, drafted by three clubs by the time you're 23. You'd probably assumed during that period of time, particularly when you're playing at a lesser level, some form of leadership in, say, playing in the second tier in the VFL. You see the opportunity to go in early because you recognise that opportunity because you'd actually been in a system where what comes to mind is you never let yourself not have a pre-season, if you know what I mean. There's no break in your life. You know, you're not thinking, oh, footy's finished, I'm now going to go to Hawaii for 4 weeks. You're thinking, no, footy's finished, I'm going to go and, you know, start my career as quickly as I possibly can. There's a certain mindset shift, which is there might be a bit of nature nurture in all of that as well, but the game in some ways has elevated that, and when you're in that environment, there's probably aspects of you that you're bringing that you don't probably know yourself, but others would then recognise in you. And often think, and I wonder what your own take in on this is. I think of my own career as actually always the most important steps were when someone saw something in me that I had yet to see in myself. And you've probably gone into that environment where people have seen something in you. Even though, as you said, you're a fresh, bright-eyed graduate, effectively in terms of the banking world, but you'd had this rich experience, good, not all good, clearly, in a high performance world.
I think it's such a good point, because when I was playing AFL, I was never going to neglect my university studies. So it was a 3-year full-time degree. I was going to do it in 6 years part-time. And I remember thinking, if I could stay in the system for 6 years, the AFL Players Association is going to pay for my whole degree. I'm going to finish AFL and I'll have a degree. I'll have achieved my childhood dream and I'll move on. And, you know, when it finished at the time, I didn't have that perspective, but that's exactly what I set out to achieve. My parents were very, very balanced and supportive around that. They had the perspective and the wisdom to say, even if you finish, even if you have a great career, where's your utility? Where's your intrinsic motivation post-career to enjoy life and maximize your potential? And having that environment was so important. The school I went to was so fortunate. Wesley, it never overemphasized that I was going to be a drafted player. It was all about the broad university education experience. And then when I finally went to ANZ, that feeling of someone believing in you, or believing in something that you don't believe in yourself, or it doesn't come naturally to yourself. Like, there was a few people, you know, there was like individuals like Richard Schroeder, Tim Maddock, I remember, and Michael Pimley. They, ANZ always trained their institutional grads or corporate finance, sort of investment banking grads, by this coach that is based in Princeton, New Jersey. And he's still my mentor. And I remember getting, you have a week or 2 weeks with him, learning the fundamentals of banking and how to assess risk and read financial statements. And there was just a moment where he could see something in me, and he continued to reach out to me proactively. And like, there was a number of other grads in this class, but we really bonded this special relationship. And even getting to New York, I interviewed in London. I came home and it was, I did my interviews in 2009. So it was right in the thick of the financial crisis, and it was a significant, you know, global event, but in the US pronounced, because you had the collapse of Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, there was just a Wachovia Bank, there was a lot of, you know, financial catastrophe. It was the mortgage crisis. Australia was relatively immune. In fact, the Australian banks had an amazing opportunity, because it was a flight to quality, and the Australian banks suddenly had all these capital coming out of their ears because the counterparty risks had changed, so they couldn't give it to the US bank anymore. They had to give it to a AA rated bank, and the Aussies had 4 of the 9. So it was quite incredible. But I had this boss, couple of bosses, John Chevelle, Richard Schroeder, and Tim Maddock. I've never called their names out in a podcast, so I'm going to do that now, because they were so important for me. And Gary Newman was another guy, and they believed me. I said, I wanted to go to New York. I want to work there, and I know that you can't transfer me, but I found a way. And I've always done two things at once. So I did footy in university. I did then banking in my master's degree, and then I did banking and my MBA. And my MBA was going to be the catalyst to get to New York, because I couldn't get a transfer. And just before I was going, I got this phone call, and my bosses in Melbourne said, hey, like, you're going to get a job. You're going to get 9 months to prove that you can build a team and create value. That's all we can guarantee. If you don't have 9 months, well, you know, you're over there and you try your best. So I went across, and I remember I was going to do a 1 year of uni. But I did it in a semester, in half the year, because I wasn't going to work. It was the first time in my life, after studying for 10 years, first time I'd be full-time university student, even though I was in my third degree. Because I always did things part-time and did two things at once. So I went over there, studied, had the best time of my life. You know, 6 months in New York City, being a full-time student, doing a executive-level program that created credits to be attributed towards my MBA. And I'm saying to my boss, like, Tim, you want me to start like January 1st? And he's like, no, you start February 1st. When you finish uni, you go and have like 6 weeks where you just have the best time and just know that you're coming back to a job and you're going to get paid. So just have fun and explore. Like, how good was that? Like, a lot of people would say, yeah, great, you know, Jan 1 was cracking on into it, see it work. He had the perspective, I think, to say, no, like, capture some of that joy.
Yeah.
Go out there and experience it and have some fun, create some memories. And then when you start in February 1, And it was probably only about 4 months in. And in fact, the CEO of ANZ New York was a guy called Doug Stolberg. And Doug was a very straight shooter. He's from Michigan, and he would chew tobacco in the office and spit in a cup. And Doug had a bit of a reputation that every afternoon he'd go past every banker and every trader and go, "How much money did you make today?" So he'd walk past, Doug would do his loop at like 4 p.m. and he'd go like, "Oh, yeah, stoner, how much money did you make today?" And like some people, they were just freaked out. They were like, "Oh my God, Doug's coming," like run to the bathroom, get a coffee. For me, I was used to that. I thought it was funny. Like, I loved it.
When you say you used to, because you were used to an assistant coach or a coach or
So how do you think you play today? Well, we've got, you know, you only had 10 kicks, you had 13 possessions and you had 3 goals kicked on you. Like, you know, I would say it's pretty, you know, we're going to have to work very hard on this and like, you know, it's a pretty poor game.
So feedback was, and feedback not altogether positive, was something that you were very, very comfortable with. And
I think you learn to deal with like constant uncertainty and negative feedback. And like I think about all the teams that I've been involved with, the most important attribute of any high performing team that I've observed or been a part of has been trust. And the greatest example of deep embedded trust is when you can provide feedback at the most transparent, real, raw level, and it is taken in a way that can move people and the organization forward, whether it's positive, constructive, lessons learned, disagree and commit, misintention or intention. It is the great liberator of performance. It's the fastest way to work out who's going to be part of the journey. It's the fastest way to work out who's ready to go to the next level. But to get to that point where you can provide it and it can be taken with in an introspective way to benefit all and to provide feedback in a way that is respectful and considered, it's a very hard thing to do, but I do, and everything I've seen, once you get to that point, the team flies. People feel safe and they go for it without the fear of making a mistake when you kick the ball.
Yeah, that's an unbelievably powerful insight.
Mm.
And the interesting thing, though, I think of Doug, was it the tobacco chewer? Was it?
Yeah, Doug's Doug.
The tobacco chewer, is that you accepted it, but a lot of people in the room didn't.
Mm.
So was that a room which had trust based on that observation?
I don't think that was one of Doug's strong points. I think at that stage in his career, it was a very much ruling by fear.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget, Doug was going, he'd been earmarked for a more senior role, and he said, "Let's get a drink." And we went to the Hemsley building, which sits above Grand Central Station around the corner from our office at 270 Park. And he said, "Come and get a beer." And I was like, "Oh, I was on the leadership team." So I was really, you know, pretty excited about that. And I've been on it for a few years. And he said, "Come and get a beer." And when we had a beer, he said, "My recommendation to the board or to the executive of ANZ was that you be the next CEO of ANZ Americas." And I remember going, "Whoa, like this is wild." And I was never realistically going to get that role, but he said that, you know, like, and that was again, I didn't see myself being ready or even remotely in the conversation, but it was someone who surprised you that had a belief in me that I didn't see in myself. And this was from a character that a lot of people revered and had. So that ability to liberate performance and belief, it's in everyone. And even if you're perceived as being cold or rigid or aggressive, there's ability to evolve and to change. And there's flexibility. And I think about my leadership style. I've had periods where my communication style is ineffective. It's not working for this audience. It's not motivating, it's demotivating, it's scaring, there's a fear of failure, there's uncertainty. And you know, and at times it's hard to step on the balcony and just assess objectively, like I might be on the right thematic, but I'm not delivering in a way that's remotely working with the team.
Yes.
And with that moment, Doug, I felt, wow, this is someone who has delivered this message in such an exciting way. Whether I was ended up going to get their job or not, he had the belief to at least promote me and nominate me and think I was in that circle. So it just shows you that there's no one is stuck in a certain way. Mind and the brain is flexible, it's malleable, it's constantly evolving, and that's leadership. You don't have to lead one way, and you do have to adjust all the time for certain individuals. And at the time I was in AFL, and there wasn't probably enough adoption of the way people receive messages and where they're at in their development, as physically, mentally, environmentally. Like to get the best out of people, it's an enormous effort, and it's evolving. So,
because normally the feedback in any shape or form, whether it's the good or bad, or the person seeing something in you that you haven't seen in yourself, and even concepts around being ready. Like, probably almost everything that you've taken on, you weren't ready for. You weren't ready for AFL football.
No.
You probably weren't ready for even, you know, the some of the responsibilities and when they put you up the front of the room, but you learnt to be ready by doing it. And then you create for yourself the second, the third, fourth, fifth point of departure of I can go from here to here to here to here because of the basis of – because say if you'd taken that job, there would have been – or that opportunity was given to you, there would have been a big part of you which wasn't ready. But I don't think we're ever ready. Would be one of the things which I think about. The second part in terms of, and we'll talk about more about your leadership experiences in the organisation which you've formed, is people do experience you in different ways. And particularly when we're actually asking people to do something different to what they're currently doing, which mightn't be, and it's only our view that they need to do something different, which is what feedback actually is given a context for that thing which potentially needs to change. But then making it compelling enough or important enough or purposeful enough or whatever it might be for them to make whatever the change they need to make in order to be that thing. And so when you were missing, when you felt, you know, your observation was that you didn't always get that right, or that there were times where that message was lost somewhere along the line. How as a leader, did you actually find that out?
It's great question. I've been so fortunate for a couple of sort of, I've had key pillars that have been able to provide that real feedback, real talk consistently. One is Alexandra, my wife.
Mm.
We've been together since we met at Derby Day in 2007.
Many a great relationship has been
That's right. It's the courtship carnival. We met and she was 20. She was just about turned 21. And, you know, we've been together now. This year in July, we're 10 years married, but we'd been together, you know, 16 years. And She's a very inspiring person. She's a challenging person. She's very determined, she has a lot of talents in different areas, which also can mean that she can often be confused because I'm probably got like a couple of things I'm really good at. Like she's good at like six things, which can be like also paralyzed with choice. But just to have that as a partner the whole way through, when I went full time at Bluestone, so the first 3 years of Bluestone Lane, which we opened 12 stores, I was still full time in corporate finance. Working massive hours in banking.
So just explain a little bit what Bluestone Lane is. I haven't really introduced
it.
Well,
Bluestone Lane's a premium Australian inspired cafe lifestyle brand, which we launched in New York City in the middle of 2013 in a hole in the wall office building, subterranean basement, Class B building, no signage. We weren't allowed a sandwich board out the front. We weren't allowed any decals, nothing. The only way to find this is if someone took you there. And this isn't 2013. Like, social media and Google Maps weren't as commonly found and ubiquitous as they are today. But it was also below this escalator I mentioned that was constantly under repair, like constantly broken. Yeah. And it was 250 square feet, so 25 square meters. Mm. And we were, and it was called Bluestone Lane because it was inspired by the cobblestone laneways that you'd find in the central business district of Melbourne. So when I walk out of our office on Queen Street or at Collins Street, what I loved about the coffee culture in Australia, and which I still do, is there's nothing about product. As much like I find it almost comical that people talk about product, like it's about the better coffee.
Mm.
People go choose their coffee shops and cafes because of feeling and because they're a local, not a customer.
Yeah,
that's why they go.
It's a beautiful line. Tell me that one again. It's a
and that's the mission of Bluestone Lane, to have locals, not customers. Yeah. Locals is about knowing someone's name, face, and order, that they're part of the community, they're part of the environment, and
connection, belonging,
connection, exactly, and ultimately, like, through what we've been through, Bluestone over the last 11 years, where right now we have about 65 locations across 9 markets, we would be the largest Australian hospitality export in the US, serving 110,000 people a week. We have about 750 staff.
Wow.
And there's an unbelievable amount of complexity in hospitality that I never appreciated. And talking about being ready earlier, I never worked a single day in hospitality and I've started this business. And what I've learned through that journey and what I've learned through assessing a lot of businesses, because prior to Bluestone Lane, I was a banker where I was advising companies on how to grow, how to be more efficient, how to create more value, how to manage risk, was that the complexity in hospitality, the team orientation is almost at the same level as elite sport because you have some factors that are so incredibly challenging, structural factors. I'll give you a great example. Our business has about 110% turnover. So if I've got 700 staff, I've got to hire 770 new staff a year in one 12-month period to remain flat, let alone if I'm growing and opening more stores and investing in other areas. Combining that with Bluestone was so many of my best teammates, we refer to staff as teammates and we refer to customers as locals only. And I had constantly a lot of Australians coming across leading certain divisions because they were familiar with the coffee culture and what we're trying to do, and everything is based on offering an authentic experience, something that would work perfectly well in Melbourne or in Sydney or in Brisbane, in inner suburb areas. They had the pull of home, so they'd come across for a couple of years, do an amazing job, and then they'd be like, listen, I want to go back to Australia. Or they came across on a one-year visa. They're a J-1 visa. They got an opportunity to work in the US for 12 months and then they're out. Or the biggest strength and probably the crowning achievement of Bluestone has been to really accelerate this knowledge around Australian coffee and cafe culture. And in New York City, we have nearly 30 stores. We are, I would say, the number one premium cafe brand in New York City and lifestyle brand. But what happens when you're at the top? Everyone wants to come in and take your best team. And in hospitality, there are enormous restrictions around really what you can pay. In banking, if someone was, was going to get an offer from a rival bank, we could often counter it with money. There was money in drawers. We could find it.
Yeah.
In hospitality or in small business, but particularly in hospitality, where you've got so much tangibility, there's so much it's consumer, it's B2C. Like, you're serving so many people. There's so many opportunities for the local to learn about your staff, to observe, that person's got the right values and, geez, they've got a good work ethic. That'd be great in my organisation. Where in a lot of organisations, you don't really know externally who the superstars are unless you're really deeply involved or working in the org. But they're constantly being poached and we could never really counter it. So that... And if you look at hospitality, that it really has no intellectual property. The intellectual property is not the recipes. It's not the real estate. The IP is all about the culture of the org, the service mentality, the selflessness that hospitality demands. Every day, every engagement needs to be memorable because all you are is your reflection of someone's perception at that time. And whether the customer walks in and they've had the worst night of their life, they've broken up with their boyfriend or their girlfriend, they've had a baby cry all night, they've lost their job, they've had someone passed away, or they've had absolutely incredible elation, they walk in and they present, and no matter what, they're right. You have to make sure that they have a great experience. So the dedication and selflessness combined with these structural challenges, it's an enormously complicated business. And it's been a great learning. But again, I had no experience on it, and I jumped in with completely different perspective. Yeah, with no rules.
We're never ready.
No, that's right.
So, because there's a couple of things which can come together here, because we're talking about the idea of how you get feedback as the leader now in the context of this. Because if the organisation is so reliant on the conditions you create, which is ultimately the culture and you know how people feel about, you know, both the experience as a local or the experience as a team member, in that sense, that if and I often use word, I always differentiate between complex and complicated as a bit of a thing, because I think a complicated issue is normally a system issue at some point. You know, we can find an answer to it if we dig deeper into it. We can fix the escalator. You know, we can sort that out.
Yeah.
A complex issue is the sort of stuff that you're talking about. And just knowing that, you know, you're going to lose, you know, pretty much all your staff every year. And within that are going to be some of your key culture people who you are going to lose. And you've probably now got a Bluestone Lane alumni, which is doing pretty well for itself, I would imagine, who have spent some really formative time being inside the organisation and the culture that you actually created and have taken that beyond that. So the first one is I'll talk to what that culture asks of you as leader, and then we'll come back to the idea of how do you know when you're not delivering on that. Sure. So what does it ask of you as leader?
One thing that I don't think I fully appreciate it when you become a founder. And founder CEO is very different from being CEO.
Yeah.
Founder CEO, you have the enormous shadow.
Mm.
It is your idea. It is your baby. Mm. You are not walking into a system. You're building the system.
Mm.
And it's built around your vision and the purpose, and your role is not just to optimize and improve. It is to dream, it's to educate, induct, and then all the other CEO responsibilities. And one thing that I didn't fully appreciate when Bluestone started and it had momentum, there was an unfulfilled need, it was created out of self-necessity, really, through my own customer centricity. I missed feeling like a local, because I'm working huge hours, and in banking we would start the day together and we would get a coffee a coffee in the afternoon, and it was the social ritual, it was the walk to the elevator, it was the chat down, it was the hanging out and the people watching. Those rituals were so important to bond, to take a break, to become a bit more human than focusing on pitch books and financial models and discussions around, you know, more rigid topics, like less creative topics, I'd say. And that's what I missed so much when I went to New York. So I would say that, you know, in leadership, there was a couple of key things. One, like as I talked about the shadow, I didn't appreciate how much people looked up to you. And you walk in a room and you think that you think they're members of the team, but you're actually the coach, and everything you do, your body language, the way that you, your tone of voice is so much more impactful than you realize. So you might deliver a message that is on point, but you deliver it in a way that is slightly off, and it's taken the wrong way. And a person that really helped me understand this was Paul Roos, actually, who did some coaching with us. And Paul talked about how he could almost finish someone's career by the way that he would look at them on a training ground. And I can completely resonate with that.
Mm.
Yeah, coach, if you did something wrong, you make a mistake. And a coach could say, all right, Stoney, next one, slow down a bit here, get your composure and you can hit the next one, versus that was just terrible. It's just terrible.
Mm.
Now, like, it's the feedback delivered and it's the body language. And what I didn't appreciate in Bluestone is if I went into a store and I didn't like something, I had to be calm. I had to be neutral. There was no point me blowing up in the store. It wasn't the right time, place. It would disrupt service. In fact, it would add more fuel to the fire and damage the business in a much greater way. And I think that that's just you have to learn how to, like, even as frustrated or as angry or disappointed. And when you're the founder, like, this is your baby. This is it. Things matter so much more than just running and leading a team. It is your, like, the feeling and the burden and also the risk. Like, the very few founders, because the risk tolerance is just not there. It's unbelievable the amount of disappointment and uncertainty you have to deal with every day. You're like, are you going to run out of money? Or are they going to come to work? Or are you going to be sued? And they're real things that happen regularly.
You can take that, if you're not careful, from inside you to outside you. People,
feel it, and then they start. You know, the biggest concern when you start behaving that way is then the belief. And as a founder, you're selling the dream. You need, and often you don't have the financial viability. You know that you have a runway of maybe 6 months of cash or 10 months. So you've got to get everyone to believe in you so much that even though you're going to technically fail and run out of money in 6 months, that they are going to choose to back you and this idea and this business over any of the other more comfortable opportunities, which may mean more financial security, more job stability. Yeah. And you're going to ask them to do things that are really tough. Like, we're building it for the first time. We're entrepreneurs. We're founding a business. So what that means is, like, we've got to do what it takes. And, like, it's not going to be a 9-to-5 and it's not going to be, like, lucrative.
Yeah.
But if we get it right, wow, imagine what could be creative. So the way that you're seen, I got a lot of feedback from my brother who joined the business when I went full-time, as I said, in 2016, my wife, and just a lot of the Aussies that I'm enormously proud of, that they're part of the Bluestone Lane system and have gone on to amazing things, and the same in banking, actually. They were the ones who were probably a bit more brave to say, hey, like, let's catch up or go for a run or do something fun. And, like, you know, I know this is really important, but, like, we're doing a lot of things right. And let's celebrate some of the success, a bit of that joy. But also, like, when you deliver that message, you can't, like, I'd really encourage you to think about delivering it in a different way. And when you walk into a store, even though you're not saying anything, if you're shaking your head or you're, you know, running around, you know, really quickly, and I used to do that. I used to come in and I'd still have my banking suit on and I'd clean the tables and wipe the tables, and people look at me like I was a weirdo because I'm in, like, you know, a suit you'd wear on Wall Street, and I'm putting cups away and I'm sweeping and I'm cleaning the snow outside in my black dress shoes. And people always look at me like, who is that guy?
Mm.
But, you know, there's a point, like, leading from the front and doing what it takes and being humble enough to know that I wouldn't ask any job of you that I wouldn't do myself.
Mm.
But the role modeling around the body language is just as important, or the delivery is just as important, the message, and you need to appreciate that. And it happens very quickly when you go from leading a team of, say, you know, 10 in banking to suddenly I'm leading a team of 250 within a year or 2 years. Those things, they're lessons you need to learn quickly if you're going to keep growing. Yeah.
Did it require bravery on the part of the people who were giving you feedback?
Oh, enormously.
Because of you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because also under stress, and And I get very comfortable with uncertain situations by going really deep into the work, and I assess risk through understanding all the potential outcomes. So for me,
of the work,
I would dive into the numbers. I would read and model and plan. It's such a detail that I'd realize, okay, well, actually, the probability of that happening is lower than what I thought, because this, if this happens, this is what I do. And I always found that served me really, really well. And I think that was from footy. Like if you don't have that much natural ability, like just find a way, like work, don't have a preseason, just train. Mm. Or, and with Bluestone, it was always like, okay, I'll just become an expert, you know? And that's where I think that there's a lot of advantages for those who, that are new to an industry or that don't have as much like maybe natural gift in mathematics or sport or whatever, that you can get better through repetition and just learning and just practicing and evolving. Like the brain constantly can improve. And, you know, I think that for me, like that was very, very important to evolve. And then, you know, but those who provided feedback that took a chance, you know, how grateful I am for their selflessness, because it was scary at times, because in times of stress and when you're so determined and you know that it can make it, but it's just not executing, it's and when you're younger, it's tough to sometimes channel that the right way. It's easy to take that determination and muscle to explode, and that does a lot of harm in the short
term. Explode as in how your response is at that time.
And lack that composure.
And you would have seen that a lot. You would have seen that a lot over the years. Yeah,
I did it a lot, and it wasn't the right thing. It wasn't a huge hindrance, because the other side of the coin is this. If Nick is such a believer and so determined, and the one thing I would always do is, like, no matter what feedback, I would always circle back to why we can do it and the belief and why you can be part of this team and that you can play, I believe in you, and you can play an amazing role here. I would never finish a conversation with, like, walking away. It would always come back to, like, I believe in you and care about you, even though I've delivered it in a, it could be a pretty binary or, you know, direct way.
Yeah.
That they could, those who did really well, I think, took it and sort of thought, Nick believes in this so much, I'm gonna double down on the effort. I'm gonna double down on the journey and the belief. And there is so many examples of those that have provided enormous value and create, you know, helped us create Bluestone Lane, which is as big as it is now, and has faced two existential crises where we were, you know, flatlined.
Yeah,
and survived.
Talk us through those.
Well, COVID was the most challenging period that I've had to deal with professionally, because when it hit on about March 13, I was in New York, and we'd actually flown out this potential new financial controller. And we were meant to have dinner as a team. He came in from Chicago. His name's Jeff Schumacher. He's working in the team now. So the circle evolves and timing. And I went to a meeting, and there was a lot of rumors about this virus in New York City. And there was this on the radio, it went out, and on Twitter went out that they were going to close the entry to in and out of Manhattan. And that this is things really serious. And I'd seen what was going on in China, but I guess we all didn't really know how significant it was. And then I went to this meeting, and I called Alexandra. And at that time, we had an apartment in West Village, and so all my clothes were there, and I'd used that as my pied-à-terre when I worked every second week in New York. And I flew. I remember going to the airport and seeing all those people with masks on, and I got on the plane to fly back to LAX. I said, I'm not going to go home. I'm not going to go back to the apartment. I'm just going to fly home. There's something wrong. Like, I just flew home. I sat next to this guy who was actually a talent agent, And he was fascinating because I got all the stories about Brad Pitt and all these Hollywood stars. I remember sitting next to him and having this amazing discussion for like 5 hours where everyone else has got masks on. I'm like, what is going on? Like, this is really weird. And I'd never seen really masks on masks other than in some of the Asian airports I'd go through and landed. And then the next day they declared a national emergency. And at that point they said there's probably over 30,000 cases in New York City. And my brother had it. My head of digital, Liam Farrow, had it. And that, and we were, and I think I had it because we're all in the same phone booth talking together. We lost 87% of our revenue in 2 weeks. Wow. So we were generating around $1 million a week in sales, about $800,000 a week in sales, and it went to, $100,000, $150,000, and the biggest challenge we had was you're paying all of your suppliers on 30 days, 60, 90, you're paying your staff on 14 days arrears. And we had, a few million in the bank and we lost all of that in a 2 week period. So we were finished. And then I had to make some very, very quick decisions and a couple of board members helped me. I mapped out a plan. I remember one board member in particular, Jamie Montgomery, came back to me and said, it's probably not enough. Like, this thing's more significant. Like, it's not going to be here just for 1 month. And the next day I let go 86% of the staff on two Zoom calls, like 650 people, one 350, the other 300. And I prioritized paying the severance that I could, which wasn't much, over paying suppliers and creditors. It was just like, that was the decision I made. But having that decisiveness and belief that I was doing the right thing paid enormous dividends, because only a few days later they announced the Paycheck Protection Program, PPP loan, and we were then able to access those funds because we had a great relationship with our banker, and we were able to then pay all of our terminated staff up front. So we provided their severance in a lump sum. We were able to then move them on to an enhanced unemployment benefit that the federal government paid. So they got the state and they got a federal. And then suddenly they went from basically, a small payout to, well, I'm earning basically what I was already earning at Bluestone and I'm being paid to stay at home. And we were back in the game. And then it was like crafting, okay, how do we rebuild? How do we, how do we stabilize? And then how do we reopen? And we had such purpose at that moment because we had to get stores that were able to trade. Many weren't. Like, California was more restrictive than New York versus, and we were only in blue states. So if you're in Florida and Texas, it was like game on. There was no COVID there, in some respects. But what we were able to do is the purpose was getting the stores open so we could protect jobs, we could provide a sense of hope for our locals. Many which were stuck in apartments were allowed out less than 1 hour a day, that were a long way away from home, that didn't have the ability to get to Australia or anywhere else in the world because they closed, you had to quarantine, or there was flight caps, all these challenges which were extreme when you think about it, like to be told that you can't get home because not only we're not letting you in, but like there's no availability on a flight because we're restricting all the flights. And when you do go there, you got to pay for your own quarantine in a hotel for 2 weeks. Like, it was, it's unprecedented. Mm. That never happened, And then thirdly, so it's to give people that sense of hope and community and normalcy. And then thirdly, it was for healthcare heroes. They were working harder than they've ever worked in their life. Mm-hmm. We had to keep them going because they were saving people on the daily. Mm-hmm. So that enormous purpose started to come through. And that was the whole, I think, transition from having locals, not customers, to actually Bluestone Lane is literally a human connection company.
Yeah.
Our purpose... Yeah. And the North Star is to facilitate connection between people. And now our real vision is to be an antidote to the loneliness epidemic. Mm. I've read a lot about this space. There's a fantastic author or professor called Norina Hertz, based in the UK.
Yeah.
She's written about that this is the greatest you know, challenge that we're dealing with in modern world, like outside, I guess, climate change and some other sort of big ones, it is the mental health and the lack of friendship with young people and the substitution of human connection with digital connectivity. And number one form of mortality for a male under 45 is self-harm. Mm. It's not drink driving. Mm. It's not drug use, or it is self-harm. So that was probably, and combined with that, we didn't have access to capital. I didn't feel confident enough to ask our investors to put in more money. And the ones that I did, the ones that had the capacity to do so, they declined. Right. They said, similar to being delisted in footy, they said, we're not going to put any money in unless we know that, you know, you're going to make it.
Yeah.
Why
would they really?
You know? Well, sometimes you got to back someone, but I think what it did actually helped me. And what it did is it made me stop second guessing and thinking that I had to go to the board. Yeah. I'm like, I'm liberated now. I'm unencumbered.
Yeah, it's up to you.
I'm going to, just like I built this thing, and then as you raise money, you probably put in more governance, and decision making becomes
gets messy,
a bit slower, and probably for good reason that there's some guardrails. They were gone. Yeah. I was back in, you know, and I had my exec team, and we had enormous trust, because I think surviving those first few weeks and making the call on the team and then moving them onto an unemployment benefit where they felt pretty happy, that suddenly there was, and then we pivoted 100% to digital, and then that decision of like, no money's coming. Like, all right, we're just going to go for it. And we turned from defense to offense. Even though we didn't have any capital, we started signing distressed leases to get away from office buildings to more inner residential areas and some suburban areas, because we only had one suburban cafe. And that ultimately was if you were going to pick a hospitality footprint during COVID, you wanted to be in the suburbs. You wanted to be where people were now going to work. So that was massive. And then it was such an incredibly inspiring time. And despite all the tragedy and challenge, I had more enjoyment that year than many of others during Bluestone, even though it was an existential crisis for the industry and for us.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of people actually have that reflection. Like, and I think it's probably in some ways goes to almost the resilience piece you talked about, as in your lessons from the game, really, in lots of ways, that you only find out, you know, people say resilience is a really important value and a really important thing to understand and have insight into, but how do you actually get it without having the extreme experience of going through it, if you know what I mean? I'm sure there's all forms of psychological profiles which would suggest some people are far more resilient than others, but my sense is the never ready type thing is part of the resilience piece as well. Is you find out, you know, even, you know, when you're a kid riding a skateboard or getting on a bike for the first time or whatever it might be, is you find out how fast you can go by when you fall off. All those things. And even in parenting, you know, your kids are going to get their hearts broken and their knees grazed. That's just part of the parenting experience. We almost have to provide for them is the opportunity to get their hearts broken and their knees grazed. It's a real challenging sort of aspect of it, because we never enjoy the tears, you know, in that sense. And so I just wonder, you know, when I talked about before about that idea of people seeing something in you that you hadn't seen in yourself, whether those periods of time actually uncover something in you that you hadn't seen in yourself as well. And again, that creates from that point onwards a new point of departure for you. I know I can do this. And I must say, there are times where even in the most, you know, difficult and tragic times of life, I'm thinking that has equipped me differently now to what I had before this tragedy happened and all that difficulty happened. You know, I spoke at my dad's funeral as an example, and it was a full house at St. Paul's Cathedral, and I remember my brother and I at the end of it saying, if we can do that, you know, we were in our 20s, and if we can do that, what can we really, we can do most things. You know, I remember thinking that.
And I think that was COVID. And I've had investors back Bluestone I had people call me up saying, like, oh, this is amazing. I'm really believing you. Can I give you some money to grow this?
Yeah.
I've been so fortunate. I've had people that believe in me. And I guess I've exhibited traits that mean believable. That they have confidence and you're backable.
Yeah,
and
you're believable in that sense. Yeah, yeah. And track record's a big part of that, isn't it? That's how, like, even trust is often, there needs mm-hmm. to be some form yep. of track record, which comes from that.
And trust also is formed, I think, dealing with adversity more than success. So that yeah. resilience point of, even though it hasn't worked out well, my AFL career on paper was a journeyman and, like, you know, wasn't great. But, like, there was the way I applied myself and the way that I continue to invest and go to the next level and approach it with determination to succeed in the next one, that builds confidence in you. And when you're looking at entrepreneurs, and I've invested in a number of private companies and I'm an advisor to a few, like, you're looking for that innate ability that you're not looking just for someone who's, it's all worked out well. And in fact, I've hired a number of kids that have come from Ivy League universities. They've been in a system and their parents probably been more helicopter parents than free-willed parents that have let you fall off the skateboard and let you ride your bike and stay out too late and get a little bit scared. It's just it's a different mentality, skill set. I think there's less tactical movability, like, you know, solving problems quickly and thinking, you know, positive about it and not overburdening it with process and just trying to find ways to move forward quickly. And it's really interesting, like, you think about it. But I think trust, so much of trust is how you respond to hard times. It is. And it's not when the conditions are perfect and the ball's bouncing to you and you're playing junk footy because you're 10 goals up. No, you assess when it's like, ball, it's windy, it's muddy, it's just uncomfortable. There could be other alternatives, but you're still committed and you're still trying and you're giving it what you can. And, like, I just think you learn so much through in those crucible moments where you've turned a crisis into an opportunity to learn, evolve, improve. And that's life. You know, life is going to constantly have challenge, but that's probably, like, the beauty of it, that you deal with challenge and you evolve and then you pass on those lessons through your actions in a team or as a leader that inspires and educates others. Because I've learned a lot through having a challenging AFL career, having some disappointments in banking, taking a big risk by moving overseas, taking a risk by starting a company, taking a risk by and dealing with something that was completely outside my control, which was COVID. And then now work from home, where all my real estate, half my real estate is, you would never open stores in office buildings nowadays when only people work 3 days a week with such a thematic. And trying to keep foster those learnings and that inner fortitude that, okay, it is what it is. I can only focus on what I can control. But I'm going this direction and believe me that my effort's there and stay with me and my positivity's there and my belief's there. And that inspires people, inspires me.
And I'm interested in your personal process in regard to that. So how do you stay in that space yourself? Do you have an active practice of reflection or any ways of which you stop and assess conversations that you have with wise people? Is there a natural rhythm that you go to, or is it quite a – you said before you went to the numbers, for example, that seems to be a little bit –
that's a big thing for me.
Yeah, so you know your numbers and in that way. So is there any sort of personal and relatively systematic – because the one thing about sport is it's unbelievably systematic, you know, not always great, but you do know what time you have to turn up. You're pretty much aware of what you have to do on any particular day. Have you got any? Have you developed any of those for yourself in taking on all that you've taken on?
There's a few things I do very methodically, which is I listen to. I love autobiographies, so I love listening to podcasts. And every time I listen to a few hosts religiously, and that, because there's always a glimmer. Or there's always something that I can relate to, that perspective or what they went through. That's not that dissimilar to what I'm dealing with.
In your entrepreneurial world or stuff outside of that as well?
I think outside, I think it's not just about building businesses, it's about being part of teams or learning. I think that's one that, and particularly when I exercise, so when I go running and I'm listening to Scott Galloway or Rich Roll, like I find that I'm not thinking about, I'm just so present. I'm running, you get the endorphins from exercise and I'm listening, and I often find I stop and write notes down. Ask that.
Yeah.
Or I do a voice memo. Like, we are often with purpose and like we should focus or we could consider doing the, and I find it's like your brain starts probably like taking LSD. You just start like seeing patterns, and I think it's the combination of exercise, your own time, and listening to perspectives, and then the thing that's held me in probably the best out of all, the ability to and the commitment to networking and socializing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking like, you know, going to the pub and drinking, you know, every night. I'm talking about like taking the time to be interested enough and to ask, would someone meet with you? And now when I was starting Bluestone, because I had no background in hospitality, I would ask people all the time, like my brother-in-law, my brother or friends, and like, tell me a bit about this. Like, why do you do that? And like, become a student. Now I, as much as it chews up time, and some people say, you don't have time to do this. You got three kids. You're growing a company. You got these other things. If someone reaches out to me and they make a concerted effort, not just like, hey, I connected with you on LinkedIn. Can we catch up?
A coffee? Yeah.
I find those meetings that I can learn, but also when I share my journey, I reflect on my story. Mm. And like, that was a really great thing we did, or that was probably, I didn't handle that well, or I didn't empower that person enough, or I didn't coach well enough, or how good was that person? Or, geez, I miss them. Or, I wish I'd love to see them.
Mm.
And I think that that's a really important one. And that transition from footy to banking, that was liberated by asking people to meet.
Mm.
And I just think it takes courage, like to write to someone, or you might know that person. Is there any chance? Think about how we connected.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
like we, I think we connected because I was listening to your podcast and said like, love what you're doing. And then it was like, oh, are you coming to Australia? And I said, yeah, well, maybe we can, maybe you want to come on the show. And then you sent me a clip about, you know, when I was meant to talk Chinese for a Hawthorn game.
Yeah, that's right. That's
back right. into that. So the Sarah, you know, again, I think put yourself out there and be open to take a bit of that risk of meeting someone new is so, it's just extraordinary. I think, and Bluestone, like that community, human connection, facilitate community, facilitate human connection. That's probably why it's worked with me, even though I didn't have any technical background in hospitality and I didn't have any ambition of working in hospitality. It's such a thing I love. I love hearing stories and learning, and that's probably, that is a crucial thing to me, that I take the time to listen to someone's journey. And it doesn't have to be I'm the founder and I'm an executive and I'm a superstar. It can be anyone in how they've dealt with adversity. What are their achievements? What are the things that light them up? What do they love talking about? Oh, I've got this trip plan. I'm going to go to China or Bhutan or Alaska or whatever. Why do you want to go there? Well, I've read about this thing. And where else have you been?
Yeah.
You know, what are you like doing? Are you into music? Are you into sport? Like, and that, having that inquisitive mindset has been, and it's, you know, I mean, I've always been inquisitive academically, but like inquisitive in humanity is probably such an underrated unlock for people who are like, oh, I want to be a better leader. I want to have, I want to be an entrepreneur or a small business owner, but I don't know what to do. Best way, I think, is just to start talking to people, socializing, socialize. Hey, I'm thinking of starting a business, but I don't know. It's amazing how people will give you ideas and you can marinate on it.
Yeah, all the time. I'm a little bit like you. I do like a little bit of them to jump through a little bit of a hurdle. I don't want it just to be they've got to
make an effort.
Yeah, yeah. As in, be really clear what you want to chat about.
Yep.
And maybe do these two or three things before we chat.
Yes.
And then find out if you then get the call back. Yep. Like people say, oh, can we just have a coffee? I want to work in footy. Or I want to do this. I go, well, just my little one is just go on to LinkedIn and just talk about look at all the careers of people on it, yes, and go onto club websites, see what roles they're all playing. And when you, we just work out a little bit about their career paths. And then when you've done a bit of work, come back to me. It's amazing how many people never come back to you.
Absolutely.
It's quite extraordinary because really almost in some ways they're looking for the solution for you. So almost the core of one of the things that I coach too is this idea of put yourself in conversation with wise people. Put yourself in conversation with wise people. Mm. And the wisdom needs to have integrity. There's no question, as in it's, I think, mostly lived, you know, in that way. But it's also got to have insight, which is sort of helpful for you, as in it's something roundabout, like it might be a conversation around resilience, it might be this. And the put yourself in conversation with wise people is you and I in conversation now, as in we're looking at each other and connecting. But listening to a podcast with, you know, whoever you're listening to, Scott Galloway or Rich Roll, or is that same sort of, that's putting yourself in a form of conversation with a wise person. I would read Seth Godin's books within 5 minutes of them coming out almost. Yeah. Like it's, and it gets to the point where I've underlined too much of the book that I have to go back and read it again and just say, because it's just for me, there's just his capacity to draw wisdom and metaphor from, which is just so relatable. Unbelievable.
I had a great day. I was in a room, 20 of us, and we had Seth Godin.
Oh, did you?
For 2 hours. I've had, you know, it's those. Yeah, it's incredible. It's empowering. But I think that's right. Like, I will not. Someone text me. I will not agree to catch up with them. Mm. I will look at and have they put in the requisite effort, just like that underpins me as a person. Have you made that investment and like on a proactive way, and then you've sort of earned the right a little bit to take up my time, because everyone's time's finite. I think that that's exactly right. But the other thing I do in addition to get inspiration is I like to vocalize. I'll go away and I'll think, and I'll maybe do a run and listen, and I'll come back and I will bounce ideas off Alexandra, my best friends, and I've got mentors. You know, I might speak to Roosie, I might speak to Ben Crow, I might speak to Michael Pimley, I'll speak to some of our investors, some of my good mates that feel very safe to give me direct feedback. And I'm going, what do you think about this? If I did that, and like sometimes they're like, no, it's just like, you know, I've got a good board. I've got some great people on the board, Danny and Jim, Jamie and what have you, that have coached me. Sue Collins is amazing. And what they will often say, and Jamie left with one, you know, amazing trait that I was trying to wicked me. His name's Jamie Montgomery. He's a very interesting guy. And he said, Nick, you don't get paid extra for degree of difficulty.
Yeah.
And that was one of those, like, I'm like, oh, my goodness. I am trying to get to here, but to get to there, I'm going this way, up and down, and then I'm going to do a pivot and pirouette, and I'm there. Yeah. And it's right.
Yeah.
And, like, that's that complex versus, you know, complicated.
Yeah.
And I only got that from, like, talking about an issue and taking the time and for them to invest in me. And just, like, if someone asked me to make a meeting, if I'm going to invest in you, I want you to prove – why I should, and that trust piece. And that was the same with Jamie. Like, Jamie would only spend time with me because my history and the investment and my education, like the things that I discretionarily made, the sacrifices you make to learn and to pay the price, earns you the right to sometimes learn more from wise people. And if they're not available, then you've got to look at alternatives like podcasts, books,
and
seminars.
And what they're doing in their own way is giving you feedback.
Yep.
The book gives you feedback, you know, the conversation gives you feedback. So even if we're in a coaching relationship, first conversation is, are you up for change? Are you up for change?
Mm.
And then the second question is, we've got to inform the change based on something. Now, are you up for feedback? And feedback might come through coaching. Yes. Like it sounds like you get that from your group, as in they say, no, you know, we wouldn't be going there, or there is a better way or a different way. But the world's giving you feedback. The, you know, the podcast you're listening to is giving you feedback. COVID gave you a big whack of feedback, you know, at that time. And now are you up for action? That's the next one. You've got to do something with it, you know. Like, even stopping mid-run when that is not your natural instinct to do, I'm sure, is you want to push it out, you want to go, you want to do it, whatever it is going through your head. No, no, I'm going to stop and I'm going to actually take, you know, 2 minutes or a minute or whatever it is to find whatever the app is that you record the note into. Then I'm going to get home and I'm going to listen to that thing. I'm now going to do something with it because, you know, if we're not careful, we've got a phone full of notes which have never actually ever been accessed at any time. And then are you prepared for some form of accountability in terms of holding yourself to the thing that you said that you were actually going to do?
Yeah.
And it sounds like by actively having like guys like Paul Roos, Ben Crow, these people in your life, you're actually ticking each of those in some ways. Probably it won't all get to the end of the line because it's a finite resource we're talking about. But it sounds like you're the sort of person who's up for that.
And having friends, long-standing friendships and family, like I can't underestimate how important that has been and the safety that's brought, and like especially living overseas where you don't have your nest and bringing up children and raising a family and dealing with challenge. The safety to know that you can always go home, that is so incredibly powerful and fortunate to Australians, to the majority of Australians. Yeah. Some wouldn't share those sentiments, but the vast majority, having lived in the US for 15 years and I've done a lot of travelling, the comfort, the pillow that you can rest your head on when you come back to Australia is amazing. And to have friendships that you formed when you were 6 years, 7 years old, and a big part of it is the team-based activity, which is very different from the US, where they do two things. They focus on specialization very early, the designated hitter, the pitcher, O-line, the D-line, the punter, the quarterback. And where most team sports in Australia are democratized, everyone's got to be able to bat, everyone's got to be able to kick, everyone's got to be able to pass the netball. It's very different. And then secondly, the participation and joy that just playing brings. One thing that's huge looking at the US system is they identify whether you're going to be in varsity, as in the top team in high school, very early. Anyone who doesn't make varsity doesn't play anymore. You're not going to play college. The fact that we have first, seconds, third, fourth, and when you go to amateurs, they have seniors, reserves, clubbies, under-19s. Like, that is a beauty of the Australian environment. And to have, you know, be able to talk with my mum, my mother-in-law, my dad, my father-in-law, my brother-in-law, my best mates from Brighton Primary or from school or who I played footy with, that has been incredibly, that has been a superpower. And I think a lot of Aussies have it. It's also a reason why a lot of Aussies would get to a professional juncture and inflection point and go, I'm actually going to go home because we're so fortunate to this environment. And it's not perfect, absolutely, and there's challenges and there's things that are wrong in the system. But I've, by and large, I think it's just incredible to come home and you're in this natural environment. And I think people are reasonably optimistic and kind and caring. And you notice it, how people, a great example was we were in Adelaide a few weeks ago and Alexandra dropped a, I'm completely diverging here, Cam, so just like edit this out if you want to. But like, you know, she dropped, I took a photo, so she put a phone cover, no, sorry, her sunglasses cover in my pocket. I didn't even realize it had her ID in it and had her lip gloss or whatever. Turned around, it was gone. And she immediately said, oh, someone's stolen it already. And we were both like, oh, well, isn't that lousy? Like, that's really annoying. Okay, we went to the party. And then the next day we went for a swimmer in Henley Beach and we were swimming next to this older couple and we said, oh, here, and you wouldn't believe it, I dropped my ID and I've lost it. And they said, someone took your ID. And someone said, yeah. And they said, oh, that's very strange. That doesn't really happen around here. I'm like, oh, okay. Then we went to the cafe the next day and walked in. Said, oh, by any chance, anyone hand this in? Well, the barista, yeah, I've got it. Brought it out. Everything was in it. And we said, oh, we thought it was stolen. And her first reaction was, really? Like, why would someone take that? And I do think that that gives you an insight into as many challenges as Australia and life in Australia has. Like, there's a big difference between US mentality and Australia. And for us, certainly, like, we were already treating this circumstance like we were living in the US. And I do think that that has been amazing to get feedback, to be in a space where people love you for who you are, not because you're a founder, not because you're an executive. And that also gives me enormous energy to realize that, hey, I can face this and I can deal with it. And, you know, it's never as good or as bad as you think at the time, Scott Galloway line. And and just to be able to socialize has been that third stool outside of education, professional development, meeting others to get inspiration and socializing. And third would be to, you know, to have these mentors and this friendship and people that can happy to provide feedback, and you just take it in the right way, and they know you, and they know that you're
a place of love, almost, isn't it? That last one, it almost comes together through, you know. And I've often talk about Ron Barassi and all that. That, you know, he was the classic extractor of someone who would push you, But I always felt that it came from love. I felt he loved me. You know, it was that sort of idea of it. And just to finish off, just with a quick little thought around, because it seems that all of these have sort of informed your values that you've really drawn to. When I talked about the podcast, is that the objective here is to lift, to shift, and challenge. To lift, you know, through you know, build connection in some way and something deeper. And the shift is some form of thinking and idea that we then take forward. And then we want people to be challenged by what they hear. Though it's just, we want it to be entertaining, but we want people to be challenged and listening to you talk and say, well, do I set myself up for those conversations? Do I set myself up for to face into whatever my, you know, tests to my personal resilience in a similar sort of way? I really love the values of Bluestone Lane. You might just talk to those.
Yeah. Well, we've gone through different iterations, and again, being a founder, you can blaze the path, and you can
make them up, mate.
You can make them up.
Yeah.
It's incredible privilege.
Yeah,
but it's a big burden. And we've gone through different acronyms, and you know, the last one we had before we landed on the values we had, which was PIC, passion, innovation, care, and consistency.
Yeah.
And I liked it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't us. It could be applied to other businesses. It could be applied to other cultures, and it just wasn't deep enough.
Yeah.
Now, what we did, and I got some feedback from, I think, Alexandra and my brother and the team, we landed on four values, which are more crucial to who we want to be and our purpose as Bluestone. And I also think that the customer centricity, it's impossible to ignore what your locals, how they're going to feel and how they think about you in a B2C business. Mm. The first one's ride the wave, and hospitality is about dealing with when the wind is onshore and it's wet and cold and you don't want to be there, and it's 6 in the morning and you got to make a coffee for someone.
Mm.
It's also when the surf's up, and when it's packed on a Saturday, you got to make your money. You don't get too many moments. You probably only make money in hospitality 2 out of 7 days a week.
Yeah.
Only 2 days a week you are profitable.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's how it works. Yeah. The coffee shops used to be 5 days. Now it's probably like 3, you know? It's hard. It's very hard. So when the surf's right, you got to go for it. The second one is mateship. Mm. And a lot of our US teammates don't understand the concept of mateship. The way we talk about it is this blend of sort of friendship and family and having great intent and looking after each other and going beyond just being a colleague and
There's a little bit of expectation in it, I think. There's a little bit of, we want something.
I think there's investment. There's an expectation on investment to know someone a bit deeper than their ability to execute a certain task or skill.
That's a much better word, investment.
There is fair go.
Yeah.
Fair go is very, very important. And where I talk about fair go, it's being fair to all stakeholders.
Mm.
And I think that this one's more about, it's not just looking in, it's looking out. If a mum with a young born gets in a car, parks the car, gets the baby out of into the stroller or the bassinet, walks down the road to the cafe, opens the door, manages the baby coming in, orders a coffee, you got to be fair. Mm. You got to be. And what's fairness? Serving with a smile, having the right atmosphere, having the coffee machine on, making a great coffee, doing it in a timely way, and enabling them to pay effectively and enjoy the experience. Mm. That might be the only time they leave the house that day. Mm. Or someone who makes a real discretionary effort to come down and they've only got $10 and they're looking for an affordable luxury experience, and we're going to be that for them. Mm. Or catching up with a friend or someone you've never you haven't seen for years.
Mm.
Make sure the environment is memorable.
Mm.
People remember service, not the product.
Mm.
So fair go for me is it's being fair to the suppliers, it's being considerate of the
Fair to the whole
ecosystem, fair to the suppliers, fair to the environment, fair to your teammates, fair to the organization. Like, you know, and that's really, really important.
Reminds
and,
me a little bit of the Rich Charlesworth stuff. He says, you know, and I talked a little bit about it on the podcast. He said, I can't guarantee I'll treat you equally, but I can guarantee I'll be doing my best to treat you fairly.
Yeah.
And I really like that differentiation because you part of your experience in the AFL is you probably got treated too equally as a 17-year-old compared with a 25-year-old. We needed to treat you fairly, not equally. You know, if we treated you fairly, we wouldn't have had the same expectations of you.
And I think there was some inequity between who's the number one draft pick and the number 82.
Yeah.
And with Bluestone, it's also treat everybody on values and their application and execution than on competency. The one thing that I dissolved very early was like I didn't care if you had worked in hospitality or not. The most important thing is your values and your life and your dedication to making a difference to someone's daily ritual. I never worked a day in a cafe. I don't know how to make coffee, but I could be very successful in hospitality. So the hipster barista walks in and tells me that like they can make the best coffee. Like I'm sort of like I don't really care about that. Like I'm not trying to offend you, but like all I care about is how you make people feel. Because like making coffee is easy. I'm just giving you the tip. Like it's just it's formulaic. It's like you follow a system. You got the right equipment. You have the right beans and milk. Like
it's again, complicated. It's not complex.
Exactly. You eliminate variables. Yeah. And it's like go on the numbers, like map it out. Like, well, that means like the probability of making good coffee is actually really high if you follow these steps. Make it formulaic. And then finally, it's bring your best. So this was a value that evolved, but it actually came from like our former head of ops and they this was more team driven. They said bring your best. And what that really means is when you're working and when you're on, bring your best effort. But when you're not, enjoy it. Do what you want. I don't mind whatever you do. You know, like you want to go and perform on Broadway. You want to paint. You want to play golf. You want to look after your baby. Whatever it is, float your boat. No worries. But when you come to work, like we're a premium brand. You got to bring your best. That's the expectation. But when you're off, you're off. I think for me that's the performance mindset. And I don't want to be a mediocre company. I've got no interest in having like just a run-of-the-mill life. I want to maximize experiences and opportunities and learning and development and bring your best ties into that. So that's our big four and
they're beautiful.
We recruit along those lines.
And they sort of tie in with that idea of sort of the, you know, I've heard you speak about this before, this idea of purpose, mastery and autonomy sort of goes to that a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because all of those things will be required in regard to that.
Indeed.
Yeah. And I've loved chatting to you. It's been great connecting and followed your story. You're actually coached by my cousin at one point, Peter Schwab. I'll tell him you're going okay.
Lovely person.
Yeah, great
and person. He was a good coach and I played most AFL games for him. So
yeah, it's cool. And I failed to actually. I was going to get a bit of feedback.
End-of-season report cards. Might have contradicted everything I've said. Lazy trainer, you know, thought he was better than what he was.
No, I don't reckon he would have. But it's been wonderful having a conversation with you and I really appreciate you jumping into the arena with our friends and we've got a pretty good group of people who are listening and really proud of what we've been able to do and I'm sure you're very proud of what you've been able to achieve and good luck with it all.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Take care.